23, Clark, Mr. Jose Mandel will present argument for the speaker.
May it please the court. My name is Jose Manuel Donatello, Assistant Attorney General, representing the appellants in this case, General Land Office and Commissioner Morrow. We've got a couple of posters or charts here that I think may be helpful to the court, and I've asked them.
Do you have copies of your charts?
Not with me, Your Honor, Justice Hightower, but I'd be more than happy to provide them to the court.
See, some of them even have trouble reading the pages.
It'd be helpful if you could get them up, too.
Is it in the brief somewhere?
Yeah, that's better.
Just so happens we did it. Yeah, approach bench.
Get it to Marshall.
My lawyer gave it to me.
May I proceed?
No.
Appellants firmly believe that Section 52-135 through 52-140 of the Texas Natural Resources Code both expressly authorize the General Land Office to hold redetermination hearings and are constitutional. A preliminary matter faced by the court, however, is a question as to whether it has jurisdiction to hear this matter or not. Oxy contends that because the underlying suit has been dismissed, this case should likewise be dismissed for mootness, and that any decision the court were to reach would be merely advisory. Appellants disagree for a number of reasons. First of all, appellants disagree that the case is moot. An actual controversy between the parties still exists. Although the case was dismissed in the Travis County District Court, we still have the administrative proceeding that is going on over at the agency level. An audit billing notice was issued, a request for redetermination hearing was filed by Oxy under 52-135C, the administrative proceeding started, then the lawsuit was filed. So the proceeding is still pending. Oxy has not specifically told the lower court, or any court for that matter, that the statutes are constitutional or that the agency does have the authority to proceed in administrative proceeding. The administrative proceeding is presently pending. The commissioner feels compelled by Section 52-135 BC and D through 52-140 to proceed and intends to do so. However, presently there's an injunction that's outstanding, and that's why we haven't moved yet.
There's an injunction in this case?
Yes, there is.
I thought it went away with the non-suit.
I haven't seen any order by this court dismissing the injunction. In my understanding,
your view is if there's a temporary injunction entered in a case and then the applicant later non-suits, that temporary injunction just goes on forever until somebody goes in there and dissolves it?
Well, the Court of Appeals could dissolve it if it's before the Court of Appeals, Your Honor, or the Supreme Court could as well, but we have not seen an order from this court dissolving that injunction. We felt that it was still in force, and that's why we have not proceeded in the matter.
If it weren't in force, could you proceed with the matter, and would you have jurisdiction to
sue this people? We surely would. We surely would, Your Honor. We read 52-135 B, C, and D as authorizing, and in fact required, not authorizing. The legislature has spoken, has told the commissioner you need to provide these, you're required to provide these redetermination hearings to people such as Oxy, and that's the way we read the statute. And until this court tells us otherwise, we're going to do it. Now, this appeal should not be dismissed for additional reasons. There are at least two exceptions to the mootness doctrine that this court is well aware of and which was briefed in our briefs. First of all, it's a capable of repetition yet evading review exception, and the other is a collateral consequences exception. We take the position that we satisfy each one of those exceptions. The elements under the capable of repetition yet evading review exception are, first of all, that the challenged action was in its duration too short to be fully litigated prior to its cessation. That's clearly happened here. Oxy filed its non-suit. As a result, arguably the case was dismissed, so this court may not hear it if the court does not have jurisdiction of the case. The second element was there was a reasonable expectation that the same complaining party would be subjected to the same action again. Down at the trial court level, when the motion for non-suit was heard before Judge McCallum, we specifically told the judge that we would proceed. and that we were sure that when we proceeded, that Oxy would be back at the trial court asking for an injunction again. Oxy did not deny that. In fact, Oxy, if it really didn't have any intentions of proceeding with another lawsuit and another request for injunctive relief, would have told the court and would have told us at that time, the statutes are constitutional, you may proceed. Or would have said, we are going to waive our right to the hearing, and as a result, we'll meet you back at the courthouse later. They didn't do that. They haven't paid the billing. They have not waived their redetermination hearing. There is still a controversy that exists. And we fully believe, because they have not denied that, that if we go back to the agency and carry out this proceeding, that they're going to be back at the courthouse one more time. And the exception, it says there was a reasonable expectation. It doesn't mean that it's a guaranteed thing. If there is a possibility that Oxy will be going back to the trial court, that satisfies the second element.
Now, let me ask you a question on the capable of repetition doctrine. Are there any cases, appellate cases, where the plaintiff had non-sued?
We did not find one. Now, we didn't. This is a case, I've never seen a case like this before. We've seen other cases, of course, where the doctrine was applied, but I did not find one that specifically had the facts that we have. But nevertheless, we feel that we fit within the exception for the reasons that I've just stated. Now, there's a second exception, which I referred to earlier, and that has to do with the collateral the consequences that will be felt as a result of the injunction that was issued by the trial court below. The General Land Office and Commissioner Morrow are concerned about the collateral effects of that temporary injunction. There are numerous administrative hearings that have commenced at the agency level, and a number of them are pending in various stages before the agency. The trial court's rulings have raised significant questions. The constitutionality of the statutes that we believe require us to hold these hearings. The oil and gas industry and the bar that practices before the General Land Office is concerned about it. They're all saying we've got this decision out here that states that the statutes are unconstitutional. We feel like our client might hold us liable if we don't move on, if we don't request a temporary injunction shutting down this proceeding. So we definitely are feeling the collateral consequences from the temporary injunction that was issued by Judge McCown, even though the case has been non-suited. Finally, there is an additional exception that I don't believe that this court has actually implemented here in the state of Texas. I know there are a number of other states that have. And it is one that I refer to as the exception recognizing that the case involves issues of public interest. There's no question that this case involves questions of public interest. What we have is a direct appeal of a ruling that statutes, specific statutes, are unconstitutional. This court promulgated that rule in the rules of civil procedure for the specific reason that it understood the importance of those issues. When someone comes in and attacks a statute as being unconstitutional, this court recognizes that it has to hear that case right away, either whether it be a temporary injunction case or a case where a temporary injunction is issued or where a permanent injunction is issued. So it is clearly an important issue that we feel this court should address and that this court should exercise its discretion favorably towards the appellants.
Counsel, after the case is noted in the trial court, Did the plaintiff there change his attitude about these matters in controversy, or any change on his part, or the county's handling of these matters that were in controversy?
I'm unaware of any change that Oxy has actually shown us. In fact, I have not spoken with the counsel.
They just withdrew to say we'll fight this battle again another time and another day?
I suppose that's what happened, and being that we didn't go back and have the administrative proceeding, Justice Hightower, that's the reason why they haven't gone back to the courthouse to get an injunction. Now, had we done that, I'm sure that's what they would have done, or at least they would have argued at some later date that the statutes were unconstitutional.
But as far as the matters in controversy, which were before the trial court, there has been no change in anybody's position as a result of the monitoring?
No, there hasn't. There's been no change whatsoever. We take the position that we're required by these statutes to hold these administrative proceedings. Required. This isn't something that we're choosing to do. The statutes require us to do it. And they, of course, have not told us that they're going to take any position other than to attack the statutes, to say that they're unconstitutional, to say that the agency does not have the authority to hold these administrative proceedings, that it's a violation of separation of powers doctrine, and that it violates their due process rights. I have not gotten a phone call from anyone stating to me that they were not going to be taking that position later. Does that answer your question, Mr. Snyder? Now, one of the things I will confess that with regard to this last exception I was referring to, the public interest doctrine, as I call it, I discovered this in a American Law Reports publication. It's an old one, and I refer the court to 132 ALR, pages 1185 through 1190, and we have a number of different states applying this type of a doctrine. We have United States courts as well that apply the doctrine. And we feel that under the circumstances and the facts of this case, that this is the perfect time for the court to start exercising that type of a discretionary doctrine as well.
This is a separate exception from capable of repetition.
Yes, it is, Justice Doggett. I am unaware of one in the state. I have not located one, but I think it's a good one. I think that this case merits such an exception. Now, there's another issue getting to the merits of the case now. There is a initial issue that was not raised, or was at least the court didn't focus on it. We think because it didn't have to, because it's so clear, that the Commissioner of the General Land Office doesn't have express authority to do what we claim is required to do here, the General Land Office and Commissioner Morrow. That 52-135, or the hearing statute, as we refer to, does not authorize the Commissioner will hold these types of hearings. I hope to stay there. There are a number of reasons why we take the position and firmly believe that the hearing statutes do indeed authorize and require the Commissioner to hold these types of hearings. There's no language in those statutes that says that the hearing should be limited to certain types of disputes. I.e. where there are no disputes about relevant lease provisions. There's nothing in there that says that the commissioner shall not interpret lease provisions, disputed or non-disputed. Secondly, it would seem illogical and unreasonable for anyone to expect that the General Land Office could audit a state lessee without reference to the leases it issues. It's got to interpret leases. It's got to look at the lease, read the provisions, and make a determination. Thirdly, the fact that the legislature provided for de novo review is an additional reason why I believe that the statute, it's clear that the statute authorizes the General Land Office to hold these type of administrative proceedings. Neither case law nor statutory law redefines the mathematics of royalty calculation. Opposing counsel
before the amendments to the statute to add in this additional hearing procedure, how did these kinds of issues get resolved between the GLO and lessee?
Justice Heck, 52-135A has always existed since 1919, and that was the one that stated that the commissioner and the General Land Office shall or has the authority to review books, records, and other documents to determine whether monies are owed. It's clear that the commissioner and General Land Office has to make those determinations.
Even and when a disagreement arose, how was it resolved?
Prior to this time?
Yes.
There were three things that the commissioner could have done. One is, under 52-176, if it was Relinquishment Act lands, or in this case, these are not Relinquishment Act lands, these are fee lands, where the state actually owns the surface and the minerals, or else they're properties that are out at, in the bay. They're fee lands, and there's a separate provision which deals with that, and that is Section 52.029. That one would apply here. It is a forfeiture provision, which specifically provides, among other things, that if the commissioner is informed of the fact or determines that royalties are owed, he shall forfeit the lease. That was one remedy that he had, or one required
responsibility. So the lessee just went to court to try to stop that?
No, he couldn't go to court to stop it. Once
he was just stuck.
That's right. Once the commissioner was informed that royalties were owed, he had the authority, and in fact, arguably, was required to force the lease. I think in the past, normally he's exercised his discretion. I know there have been instances. For example, there's the Magnolia case. I'll give you the cite on that one, where the Commission of the General Land Office, that was a 1935 case, 83 Southwest 2nd, 929, where the Commissioner of the General Land Office in that case forfeited a lease. Didn't give him any warning, just did it.
Why is there a case if they couldn't sue to stop
it? It was a mandamus.
Well, that's what I asked you. If the commissioner made this determination before, mm-hmm. How was it reviewed?
Well, how was it reviewed by mandamus? But that was one of the procedures that the commissioner would follow or could follow. Another is, there is under 52-136 a statutory lien that would be applied to the proceeds from production from the lease, if he were to determine that royalties were owed.
Let me try again. Before the amendments to the statute that we're concerned about in this case, if a dispute arose between the commissioner, the GLO, and a lessee about what was owed under a lease, how did that dispute get finally resolved? Did it go to court? Did somebody have to sue? Did they have to put up the money? How did it get resolved?
Well, the lease was forfeited, and if the commissioner of the General Land Office, if it was determined by this court, pursuant to an application for a mandamus, that he had abused his discretion, then at that time he would be mandamus, or told that he would be mandamus to reinstate the lease. Now, the forfeiture provision also allowed the commissioner of the General Land Office to exercise discretion in reinstating the lease. So if he had forfeited the lease, and the operator, the lessee, came in and said, all right, let's work this thing out, let's resolve this thing, and I promise you that this won't happen again, and we have an understanding as to how much I'm going to owe you in royalties and what I owe the permanent school fund, that the commissioner at that time could have reinstated the lease. He had that. He could exercise that discretion. So that was another way that the parties could come to some satisfactory resolution of the matter. Now, finally, what would happen? Does that answer your question, Justice Hatch?
Well, so I'll understand. Your position is, before these amendments were enacted, the commissioner did not have to sue, and the lessee could not sue, and the only remedy available to the lessee if he didn't like the commissioner's decision was to mandamus.
That's my understanding of what the law was. The lessee clearly did not have legislative authority to sue the state. He'd have to go to the legislature to get that. He didn't have that until there was a forfeiture, and at that time, then he had his remedy. That's exactly what happened in the Magnolia case, that 1935 case. And then, of course, the final option would be for it to be referred to the Attorney General's office for collection. With respect to the issue of separation of powers, now, Mr. Shenkin, who represents Amicus here, Rutherford, and Mr. Westmoreland, who represents Oxy, both of them are going to get up here and make the argument that the rights that they have in the leases at issue are common law rights. There couldn't be anything further from the truth. There is no common law right that exists here. It's a statutory right which is created pursuant to Chapter 52 of the Natural Resources Code. Without those statutory provisions in the Texas Natural Resources Code, Chapter 52, they would not have any authority whatsoever to explore, to develop, or to produce any of the permanent school fund minerals that are issued in this case. So there is no common law right. And it's well settled countless times by this court. I think there was, during a three-month period in 1986, I believe it was March, April, and May, this court issued three separate opinions in the case that's referred to as Saida, another case that's referred to as the Grounds versus Tolar Independent School District case, which I believe Justice Gonzalez wrote the opinion for the court in that case, and the Blount decision, which is the latest decision by this court, where this court expressly recognizes that when a party's rights are obtained pursuant to statute, their statutory rights, that the legislature has the authority to spell out the remedy available to that party. In the case of Saida, it involved the Catpool cases. In the case of Blount, that involved the ERS, the Employment Retirement System. In both those cases, this court said it was perfectly fine for those agencies to adjudicate contract rights. That's what we're doing here. And that also goes for the Grounds versus Tolar Independent School District case.
if the review here under this statute were not de novo, would you have any problem with the GLO making a decision that could only be reviewed by substantial evidence?
That's a tough question. I had to face that once before, because at one time I believe there was some talk about it being under substantial evidence review. But I suppose if you're reading the cases strictly, yes, it would be fine to do that. But in this case, they don't have that. In fact, in the if I'm not mistaken, the Blanton Saida cases, that's exactly the type of review that's involved.
That would make it pretty one-sided, would it?
The court didn't seem to have any problems with that in the Blanton Saida cases. But in this case, there is not that argument, Justice Heck. Here we do have a trial de novo, which is, as I pointed out earlier, is another reason why we have got to believe that this statute grants the authority and the responsibility on the Commissioner of the General Land Office to hold these hearings. Why would there be a trial de novo if all we're doing was adding and subtracting? No, you owe me 15 cents instead of 11. There's nothing difficult about that.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Are we done?
The red light is on.
Thank you.
We have an opportunity for the public. Court is ready to hear argument from appellee user and
me. May it please the court, Mr. Kent Westmoreland and Mr. T. and Stanton will give an argument for the respondent. Mr. Westmoreland will open.
May it please the court, let me first say that I feel a little bit like the tail wagging the dog. This case has very little to do with Oxy USA, my client. Instead, we believe it's an attempt on the part of the GLO to relitigate the Rutherford case. Opinion's already been written in that case on a temporary injunction issue, and also to circumvent the appellate process that is currently ongoing in Rutherford. And the GLO wants this court to decide some constitutional issues about the Texas Natural Resources Code in a purely hypothetical situation.
What is the status of the Rutherford appeal?
It's my understanding that the trial court in Rutherford has entered a judgment, I think it was based on a summary judgment, that the appellate process has been triggered by a notice of appeal on the part of the GLO, and that a briefing schedule is in the works. Mr. Schenken, who represents Rutherford, can address that better, perhaps. But it's our point that the issues involved in that case, involving not only the interpretation of the code, but possible constitutional issues as well, will be before this court in due course.
But the state is correct that you have not disavowed an intention to keep going back for temporary injunctions as long as it takes to keep the GLO from continuing these hearings. Is that true?
That is not true. And that never was our purpose, to put the resolution of these issues on indefinitely. In fact, following the granting of the non-suit by the trial court, we contacted the attorney for the GLO, who's a separate attorney other than Mr. Ron Hell, to ask them about what type of scheduling they wanted to have on the hearing process. So we were ready at that point in time to go forward with it, and they advised us that they weren't ready to go forward with it until this appeal was decided.
So your position at this point is, let's go forward with the GLO hearings and we'll just pursue whatever remedies we have in due course.
That's correct, and I think we're also interested in what happened in the Rutherford case. Let me give the court a brief background in terms of the facts of why we're here.
Before we get to the Rutherford case, does that leave a case in controversy here? I mean, if you're willing to submit to $135 million.
We don't think there's any case in controversy between Oxy and the GLO at this point in time. We've taken a non-suit. The trial court had a hearing on it. The trial court determined that an order of dismissal was appropriate, that there was no affirmative relief being sought by the GLO, and an order was entered, and the GLO sought not to appeal that order. So it's a final order, and we're ready to go forward with the hearing process.
Let me see if I understand you correctly. Do I hear you say that there are no barriers, as far as you're concerned, from the General Land Office to continue with these type of hearings, and you will not put any roadblocks to these hearings.
With respect to our position right now, we're ready to go forward with a hearing. We don't necessarily feel that they're constitutional. We believe that what they're trying to do is unconstitutional.
Well, you can't have it both ways. Well, you may be making that argument at the time of the hearing to some tribunal somewhere. And if you are, then we do have a controversy.
Well,
that is right for us to consider.
We don't believe there's a controversy that's right to consider, because we believe that the statute itself must be interpreted to determine whether or not the way it's interpreted is unconstitutional. And that's the issue that's involved in Rutherford right now as we proceed. And let me give you the background of what happened in this case when we filed our action and sought a temporary injunction. Probably my fault when the temporary injunction was drafted. While it relied on Rutherford, it improperly stated what the Rutherford court had held. And after that occurred, we had the order. We attempted to negotiate with the GLO to have the temporary injunction order amended to reflect what the Rutherford case really said. The Rutherford case, as I perceive it, didn't say that the statutes were unconstitutional per se. They said that the entire process, in terms of a temporary injunction hearing, that Rutherford had proved that there was a probable cause that harm would be done because of the unconstitutionality, so there's a probable right to recover, and that there was irreparable harm. When we went to draft our order, the court entered an order simply saying that the statutes were unconstitutional. And we think that this matter is not ripe for this court at this point in time, because the question first needs to be determined how you interpret that statute. And then secondly, if you interpret it in such a way that it appears that it will violate the due process rights and the separations of powers, then you get to the constitutional issues, but only then.
This court can proceed to dismiss this as moot, as you requested.
Yes, sir.
You're ready to proceed to the General Land Office with the hearing, but subject to your objection concerning constitutionality.
Yes, sir. Subject to what eventually happens in the Rutherford case.
And you plan to address these exceptions to the mootness doctrine that your proposal counsel has presented here?
Yes, sir, I will. We believe that it's moot for three reasons. The first is that we had the right to take a non-suit, and when we took that non-suit, the case was over and the temporary injunction order was dissolved. There's no temporary injunction order when you don't have a suit or controversy outstanding. Second, we believe that...
Would that have been true if the state had answered and affirmatively pled the constitutionality of the statute?
Probably not. Or if the state had sought any other type of affirmative relief in connection with its counterclaim.
Well, if they'd just come in there and put in a count for attorney's fees and defending the constitutionality of the statute against your attack.
Well, I hadn't thought about attorney's fees, but to the extent that the trial court made a determination at the non-suit hearing that there was no, that the GLO did not seek affirmative relief, which is what the trial court found, we believe that the case is over at that point in time.
So if there's nothing the state could have done, is what you're saying?
No, the state...
To prevent, come in and file a lawsuit attacking the constitutionality of a statute in the manner in which an elected official is proceeding, pursuant to what he perceived to be at least his statutory duty, and you get more relief than you really want, and so then you want to say, King's X, I don't want to try it, I don't want to take this one up on the field. Is that...
That is, to some extent, is correct in the sense that what is going to come up to appeal what the court is going to have to address is not really ripe for being addressed at this point in time. And I admit that I believe I was duped to some extent in the manner in which I drafted the temporary injunction order, because I don't think it correctly stated what the Rutherford opinion below had held.
Duped by whom?
Well, not necessarily duped, but just made a mistake with respect to the manner in which the temporary injunction order was drafted, in conjunction with having presented it to Mr. Ron Hell and having had his changes incorporated in the order that was eventually submitted to the court for entry. Going back to fundamental facts of this case very briefly, because I think it's important in terms of not only the mootness but the constitutionality. My client, Oxy, was a lessee with two other offshore oil companies that had entered into independent gas contracts with the same pipeline company. And those gas contracts had a take-or-pay provision, and they also had a provision which allowed for price redetermination on the part of the producer, but also if you asked for price redetermination, it had a provision which allowed for unilateral cancellation of the contract. At some point in time, because of the soft market, the pipeline company did not take the gas that it was said it would take, which gave rise to take-or-pay claims. Two of the producers of gas negotiated a settlement with the pipeline company whereby they gave up their take-or-pay claims but sought a higher price and got a somewhat higher price in terms of the gas they produced. Oxy did not want to give up its take-or-pay claims, and it did not seek the higher price because it felt that if it tried to get a price redetermination, it might get the contract canceled out from under it. Oxy paid royalties based on the gross proceeds that it received. The GLO took the position that, no, these other parties are paying more, so that must be the market value. And we said, no, that market value, that's not the market value because it takes into consideration the take-or-pay settlement. They sent an audit billing notice. We responded. We started the hearing process. We got to a point about 2 weeks prior to the hearing, and they withdrew the audit billing notice. About a year later, in May of 89, we got an amended audit billing notice, which included a claim for royalties and penalty and interest for our take-or-pay settlement. We think that's important because we think it's in the separation of powers and the due process arguments, and I'll very briefly address this. We believe that where a legislative branch is deciding legal issues that are very complicated legal issues. We have a Fifth Circuit case that's held in our favor in terms of how you construe a lease and whether or not take-or-pay payments are required as royalty. And an Idaho, I think, or Wyoming Supreme Court case that also finds in our favor. And yet the GLO is going to have its commissioner make these types of legal decisions as to construction of contracts and as to what these contracts mean that we think fall solely within the power and authority and experience of the judges in the state. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
May it please the court, my name is Pete Schenken. I represent Rutherford and Conoco. We were the prevailing parties in the Rutherford case that the General Land Office makes the principal burden of their application of writ of error to attack. And I want to address first the mootness issue, first by amplifying on Mr. Westmoreland's answer to your question, Justice Peck. The status of the Rutherford case is that we did secure a summary judgment on the merits that the GLO does not have the statutory authority to adjudicate the contract rights of the parties to a state mineral lease. On January 4, 1990, after having sought such a ruling since December of 1987, and the effort to evade review here of the issue, first whether they have the statutory authority, and then if they do, is it constitutional? The effort to evade review has been on the part of the GLO. My client has sought diligently to present that issue for the resolution by the courts.
What have they done to thwart the resolution of this issue?
Well,
will you articulate, you know, the charges you're making against the GLO?
Yes, sir. Justice Gonzalez, what we did first is we sought a temporary injunction from the district court. We obtained one. At that time, the GLO was willing to concede that what it was proposing to do to my client, Rutherford, was an adjudication. And the temporary injunction was decided on that basis, and we got a temporary injunction. The GLO then went into another case and said, no, we were wrong about that. It's really not an adjudication. And they persuaded the judge to deny a temporary injunction in that case, and then to come back, came back into our case and got him to dissolve our temporary injunction. That required us to take an appeal to the Court of Appeals on the dissolution of the temporary injunction. That appeal, during the course of that appeal, the GLO started in their brief with the argument, we're not adjudicating anybody's rights here, said that in their brief, and then conceded at oral argument, as it seems to me they clearly had to do, that in fact what they were doing was adjudication. And at that point, the Court of Appeals decided the dissolution of the temporary injunction issue and wrote the opinion to which counsel objected. Then we were, of course, sent back to the district court, and the effort was to secure a hearing at which we could have our summary judgment ruled on, and we thought diligently through that, and for various reasons, which I don't think need to trouble the court, it took a long time before we could get a hearing date that we, well, as an example, the GLO insisted on rebriefing all the summary judgment issues, even though they already been having another argument on it.
You're about to run out of time. I suggest you move on to your substantive issue.
The substantive question is, should the GLO be judged in its own cause?
Is it really doing that? Isn't this purely up to the lessee to invoke this hearing process?
Only in the it's form over substance to say so, Mr. Justice Heck. The way the procedure works is you have to pay them all they demand within 30 days of the first time they demand it or request a hearing.
Well, but you have to do that whether you're going to court or not.
You do under this procedure, but you didn't under the prior procedure, the one that you asked Mr. Ron Hell about. You did in the situation of either the forfeiture or what happened more often of the cases, the Attorney General suing the collective allegedly deficient royalty, you did not have to pay first.
So, but doesn't that mean that the focus of your complaint is not on whether there's this alternative hearing procedure, but whether you're going to have to put up your money before you get a judicial determination of the issue?
I contend that both are important, but obviously the importance of the hearing procedure is greatly magnified. The General Land Office's leverage through its administrative proceeding is greatly magnified by being able to require the lessee to pay first before he can litigate. No question about it.
So I'll be sure, you have to pay first before you can litigate whether or not you opt to go through the hearing.
Only if the GLO is right that the only two options are those set out in the statute, and that the GLO is right that is intended to apply to bona fide disputes between the GLO and its lessee over whether the GLO is right about the meaning of the lease or the lessee is right.
If the legislature rewrote the statute and said, you can go ask the commissioner to reconsider, you don't have to, but whether you litigate it or not, you're going to have to put up the money first. You would attack that on constitutional grounds as well, or not? Could the legislature prescribe the payment of the disputed royalty as a condition to go into court?
I think they possibly could with regard to new leases entered into after the date of the legislation. I think there would be a separate question that would apply to leases such as in this case, one that dates back to 1974 or some such date.
Certainly in tax cases, for example, you either have to pay your money and sue to get it back in an Article 3 court, or you can not pay your money and dispute in an Article 1 court, but you don't there are no other options than those.
Well, that's certainly true, but I think that is really clearly distinguishable. Only the sovereign can tax. No private party can tax. But anyone, including the sovereign, can enter into a lease. And when he does so, the law, contrary to what Mr. Rangel says, is that it is a common law right that he is exercising. The Christo versus Plum case, this court discussing the general land office, the very agency in question, entering into a contract, said the general land office, as the vendor, has the vendor's right under common law to, and then filled in whatever the particular common law right was that was requested. Simply not true that absent 52-135, the GLO couldn't enter into leases. They've been entering into leases since long before 52-135 or its predecessors, and they don't have to. The legislature does have the power, and the voters through the Constitution have the power to limit the state's power to enter into leases, and not supposed to bar the state from entering into any leases whatsoever. But that does not create the power to lease. The texture of law that the state has the power to enter into leases. It is a common law right, nothing like the Cat Pool Act, which you have no right to buy cat pool insurance. The whole point of the act is to require a group of insurance companies to sell insurance under stated terms and conditions.
If you simply excise the hearing procedure out of this statute, and it was left that you must pay the disputed royalty amount to the commissioner before you can sue in district court, you would still attack that, or you would not attack it?
In the case of Rutherford, we would still attack it, it seems clear to me, because we are operating under a lease that long antedated such a doctrine. And part of the reason why I think it would be preferable for Your Honors to take this the question up in a live case that involves and is on its way to you is that the facts of that case, my case, are in my case. And they are not in this case, and you would be able, I think, to appreciate in that context some of the reasons why this court's doctrine of avoiding reaching serious constitutional questions, if it's fairly possible to do so by construing the statute, should be applied here.
Your argument is basically wait for Rutherford.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would add it's not just Rutherford. No one, I gather, has mentioned in briefs to this court, perhaps, but there is another case, the Flagg-Redfern case, which was the one that the General Land Office went over to when they lost the temporary injunction in Rutherford. That's already at the Court of Appeals and already fully briefed in the Court of Appeals. And it also involves the same issue, the statutory authority and, if you have to reach it, the constitutional issue as presented in the Rutherford case.
My record has separate counsel from you.
Yes,
so we don't know which one of those cases will be resolved first.
We do not, and of course my own expectation, intention is to move for consolidation in the Court of Appeals and try to get them decided as a package. Flag Redfern also went up to the Court of Appeals on the temporary injunction. We briefed separately and argued separately, but the Court of Appeals wrote the opinion in our case and then wrote a decision in the Flagg-Redfern case that said see our opinion in Rutherford. So the matter is definitely on its way to you, barring obviously a drastic change of heart on the GLO's part, in a case in which you'll have the statutory issue briefed and a factual record, at least of some sort, at least it pertains to some extent to summary judgment. So that would be my suggestion to you. On the other hand, if you do choose to address it here, and I hear what Mr. Rangel is saying about the public interest, and there is clearly a public interest in having the question resolved of, is it right, is it lawful under the statute and constitutional for the GLO to decide whether the GLO's audit division or the lessee is right about the interpretation of the lease? There is a public interest in having that question decided, and if you feel that this meets some mootness exception and you want to take it up here, then we would like to brief the statutory question, which has not been briefed to you and has been touched on very lightly in argument this morning. But as I say, it seems to me that this issue is not evading review. It's on its way to you, and that would be the better course.
So your position is that no exception to the mootness doctrine applies?
Yes, and I suppose I should briefly touch on the only one that I think has not been mentioned in subsequent argument from this side of the room,
collateral consequences one. I think you've addressed the taser controversy clearly. Maybe one supplement to that point. I think counsel for the Attorney General was asked, are there any cases about a plaintiff taking a non-suit? And I believe there is a case that Oxy's counsel has found that I don't think was in the briefs, in which the finding had been made that the non-suit was in bad faith, but this court directed that the non-suit be honored. And there's certainly no such finding been made here that Mr. Westmoreland is in bad faith. But to the collateral consequences doctrine, which is the other exception that Mr. Ron Hill urged upon you, it's not been addressed. If there are collateral consequences here for the general land office affecting its interpretation of the statute and the Constitution, those collateral consequences flow not from the Oxy temporary injunction, which was wiped out by a non-suit within 30 days of its being entered. They flow from the temporary injunctions in Rutherford and Flag Redfern cases and the Court of Appeals opinion last summer and the judgments on the merit in those cases. And all of those cases are the ones that create any duty that there may be on the part of lawyers or conscientious lawyers for lessees to raise these issues on behalf of their clients. So they don't flow from the mooted occupancy injunction.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you. I'll try to argue my rebuttal in the order of the presentations that were made, starting with Mr. Westmoreland. Though I would like to make one comment that I'm afraid I may forget. I would like